exceptional exuberance. Despite the article's tone, you could almost hear the harumph, the editor's impression was correct. I'd come to realize we'd never be able to identify irrational exuberance with certainty, much less act on it, until after the fact. The politicians to whom I explained this did not mind. On the contrary, they were relieved that the Fed seemed disinclined to try to end the party. Ironically, very soon afterward, we ended up tightening interest rates all the same. Between mid-1999 and mid-2000, we raised the Fed funds rate in steps from 4.75% to 6.5%. We did so first to take back the liquidity we'd added to the system to safeguard it during the international financial crisis. Then we took back a little more to build a bit of insurance, as Bill McDonough put it, against the tightness of the U.S. labor market and the possible overheating of the economy. In other words, we were positioning ourselves to try for another soft landing when the business cycle ultimately turned. But stock prices were largely undeterred. They didn't peak until March 2000, and even then, the bulk of the market moved sideways for several months more. Those challenges lay in the future as the world paused to ring in the new year on December 31, 1999. The hottest ticket in Washington was the dinner at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and Andrea and I were invited, along with Muhammad Ali, Sophia Loren, Robert De Niro, Itzhak Perlman, Maya Lin, Jack Nicholson, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Bono, Sid Caesar, Bill Russell, and scores more. To celebrate the new millennium, the Clintons were planning a huge extravaganza, a dusk-to-dawn affair starting with a black-tie dinner for 360 at the White House, then a nationally televised entertainment spectacle at the Lincoln Memorial produced by my friends George Stevens Jr. and Quincy Jones. American Creators was the theme. Then, after midnight and fireworks, it would be back to the White House for breakfast and dancing till dawn. I already had an inkling about what the new millennium held in store for me. I'd received word from John Podesta, the White House Chief of Staff, that President Clinton wanted to reappoint me for a fourth term. I'd said yes. To be involved in the analysis of the world's most vibrant economy, then be able to apply that analysis to decisions and have feedback from the real world, I couldn't think of anything I'd rather do than serve as Fed chairman. I was 73, true, but I saw no diminution of my creativity or of my ability to handle mathematical relationships or of my appetite for work, changes that would have made me hang up my spurs. In his book, Maestro, about me, Bob Woodward wrote that being reappointed put me in a state of sober rapture. I have to admit, I was having fun. All this added a happy glow to the holiday season. Though the announcement of my reappointment hadn't yet been made, and Andrea and I had to keep it to ourselves. She'd bought a dress for the White House occasion, cut velvet burgundy and black Badgley Mischka, and looked ravishing, even though she'd been working at her usual intense pace and had the flu. The Millennium Dinner filled both the East Room and the State Dining Room, which, as a reporter gushed the next day, were transformed into a fantasy of white and silver, with white orchids and roses set atop silver velvet tablecloths. I don't have much of an eye for such things. But as we nibbled beluga caviar and sipped champagne, what did strike me was that both host and hostess seemed genuinely pleased. He rounding out his second term as president, she preparing to launch her political career with a run for the U.S. Senate. The president toasted the guests. I cannot help but think how different America is, how different history is, and how much better, because those of you in this room and those you represent were able to imagine, to invent, to aspire. After 7 years in the White House, after the trials of Bosnia, the sleaze of Monica Gate, and a historic economic and financial boom, this was the Clintons' Camelot moment. The dinner broke up a little after 9, and the crowd moved to the buses that were to take us to the Lincoln Memorial. But Andrea and I peeled off. We had another millennium gathering to attend. On the way to the party, we'd stopped off at the Fed, where a sizable team was poised to work through the night to monitor the transition of the nation's financial systems. The Fed had devoted years of effort to ensure that the turn of the millennium would not be a disaster. The threat was from obsolete software, the Y2K bug, it was called, embedded in computers all over the world. In order to save precious computer storage capacity, programmers in decades past had routinely used only 2 digits instead of 4 to represent the year, So, for example, 1974 would show up simply as 74. As I wrote programs using punch cards in the 1970s, I'd use this technique myself, writing programs on punch cards at Townsend Greenspan. It had never entered my mind that such programs, extensively patched, might still be in use at the end of the century. And I never bothered to document the work. There was understandably widespread concern that the shift from 1999 to 2000 might cause such software to go haywire. This potential glitch was often devilishly hard to detect and costly to fix. But in Y2K doomsday scenarios, the consequences of failing to do so were dire. Vital civilian and military networks would crash, causing electricity to go out, phones to fail, credit cards to stop working, airplanes to collide, and worse. To prevent chaos from breaking out in the financial system, Fed Governor Mike Kelly had spearheaded a massive 2.5-year drive to modernize the computers of America's banks and of the Fed itself. The Fed had worked hard to mobilize other central banks around the world to do the same. Tonight, we were to learn whether all those precautions had paid off. Mike and his team had sacrificed their holiday to man a command post on the terrace level of the Fed's William McChesney Martin building, where they'd fitted out a big room near the cafeteria with phones and screens and televisions and workspaces for about 100 people. The kitchen was open. There was no champagne, but plenty of non-alcoholic sparkling cider. When Andrea and I stopped in, the team had already been there all day, watching celebration after celebration on TV as the millennium made its way around the globe. First, the new year had come to Australia, then Japan, then the rest of Asia, then Europe. In each of those places, the TV coverage would show the fireworks, of course, but what Mike and his team were really watching was the city lights in the background to see if they were still on. I felt out of place walking into this scene in black tie. Most everybody else had on a red T-shirt bearing a patch emblazoned with an eagle on a red, white, and blue shield and the words Federal Reserve Board and Y2K. Mike, who had been keeping me up to date, said things were still going remarkably well. Britain had just entered the 21st century, apparently without problems. We were now in the hiatus as midnight crossed the Atlantic. The United States would be the last major economy to go, which added to the suspense, because after all our poking and prodding of other nations, it would have been an embarrassment to have our systems fail. But we were extremely well prepared. The U.S. financial industry had spent many billions of dollars replacing and updating old systems and programs. Crisis management teams stood ready in every Federal Reserve District and in every major bank. The FOMC had released billions of dollars of liquidity into the financial system, using options and other innovative techniques. And in the event America's credit card system or ATM networks broke down, the Fed had even positioned stockpiles of extra cash at 90 locations around the United States. Having had a hand in creating the problem, there was no way I could have shown up at the office on January 3rd without having visited the troops in the trenches on the eve of potential catastrophe. We didn't know it then, but the huge investments directed at clarifying and rationalizing all the undocumented pre-Y2K programs greatly enhanced the flexibility and resilience of America's business and government infrastructure. There were no more undocumented black boxes to try to puzzle out when something went wrong. I suspect a good part of the surge in productivity in the years immediately following was owed to those precautionary Y2K investments. From there, Andrea and I headed home. It was only 10:30, but we felt strangely as though we'd already seen the new millennium come and go. By the time midnight finally reached Washington and began to cross the United States without incident, we were tucked snugly in bed. Chapter 10 Downturn. My first meeting with President-elect Bush took place on December 18, 2000, less than a week after the Supreme Court decision that enabled him to claim his election victory. We met at the Madison, the hotel about 5 blocks from the White House, where he and his team had set up shop. This was his first trip to Washington as President-elect. We'd met a few times over the years, but had spoken at length only once before, on the dais at a banquet that spring. The breakfast at the Madison included Vice President-elect Cheney, Bush's Chief of Staff Andy Card, and a couple of aides. The situation had a familiar feel. I'd briefed 5 previous incoming presidents on the state of the economy, including, of course, the President-elect's father. In this instance, I was obliged to report that the short-term outlook was not good. For the first time in years, we seemed to be faced with the real possibility of recession. The deflation of the tech stock bubble had been the great financial drama of the preceding months. The Nasdaq lost a stunning 50% of its value between March and year-end. The broader markets declined far less. The S&P 500 was down by 14%, and the Dow by 3%. But while the total losses were small in comparison with the paper wealth that the bull market had created, these were significant declines, and the Wall Street outlook remained gloomy, putting a damper on public confidence. Of greater concern was the overall state of the economy. For much of the year, we'd appeared to be entering a mild cyclical slowdown. This was to be expected as businesses and consumers adjusted to the effects of so many boom years, so much technological change, and the deflation of the bubble in stocks. Indeed, to foster this adjustment process, the Fed had tightened interest rates in a series of steps from July 1999 to June 2000. We were hoping we might achieve another soft landing. But in the past couple of weeks, I said, the numbers had slipped badly. There had been production slowdowns among automakers and other manufacturers, lowered estimates of corporate profits, swelling inventories in many industries, a marked rise in initial unemployment claims, and a weakening of consumer confidence. Energy was putting a drag on the economy, too. Oil had spiked up to more than $30 a barrel earlier in the year, and natural gas prices were up. Then there was the anecdotal evidence. Walmart had told the Fed that it was cutting back its expectations for holiday sales, and FedEx reported to us that shipments were below predictions. You can't judge the health of the economy by the length of the lines to visit Santa at Macy's, but it was mid-December, and anyone who had gone Christmas shopping knew that the stores were eerily quiet. Despite all this, I told the president-elect, the economy's long-term potential remained strong. Inflation was low and stable, long-term interest rates were trending down, and productivity was still on the rise. And, of course, the federal government was running a surplus for the fourth straight year. The latest forecast for the 2001 fiscal year, which had just begun in October, had the surplus at nearly $270 billion. As breakfast ended, Bush asked me aside for a private word. "I want you to know," he said, "that I have full confidence in the Federal Reserve, and we will not be second-guessing your decisions." I thanked him. We chatted a bit more. Then it was time for him to leave for meetings on Capitol Hill. There were cameras and reporters waiting as we walked out of the hotel. I assumed that the president-elect would just go up to the microphones, but instead he put his arm around my shoulders and brought me along. An Associated Press photo from that morning shows me smiling broadly, as if I'd just gotten good news. Indeed, I had. He'd zeroed in on the issue of most pressing importance to the Fed, our autonomy. I wasn't yet sure what to think about George W. Bush, but I felt inclined to believe him when he said we weren't going to have fights about monetary policy. I felt relieved that the election crisis had been resolved. In unprecedented circumstances, after 36 days of hanging chads, recounts, lawsuits, and bitter allegations of vote tampering and fraud that in other countries would have caused rioting in the streets, we'd at least achieved a civil conclusion. Though I'm a lifelong libertarian Republican, I have close friends on both sides of the political aisle, and I thought I understood the Democrats' dismay at seeing George W. Bush take the White House. But it is worth focusing on how rare it is in world politics for a bitter political brawl to end up with the opposing candidates wishing each other well. Al Gore's concession speech ending the presidential race was the most gracious I'd ever heard. "Almost a century and a half ago," he said, "Senator Stephen Douglas told Abraham Lincoln, who had just defeated him for the presidency, 'Partisan feeling must yield to patriotism. I'm with you, Mr. President, and God bless you.' Well, in that same spirit, I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country." While I did not know where George W. Bush would lead us, I had confidence in the team that was taking shape. People wisecracked that America was witnessing the second coming of the Ford administration, but what was just a witticism to them meant a great deal to me. I'd started my public service in the Ford White House and looked back to those years as something special. Gerald Ford was a very decent man, thrust into a presidency that he had never sought and that he probably would never have been able to win on his own. As he showed in his race against Jimmy Carter in 1976, he was not very good at the bare-knuckle politicking of a presidential campaign. His dream had been to serve as Speaker of the House of Representatives. Yet in the turmoil of a president resigning in disgrace, he'd proclaimed, "Our long national nightmare is over," and gathered around him as talented a group of people to run government as I have ever witnessed. And now, in December 2000, George W. Bush was staffing the core of his government with Ford administration stalwarts, a lot older and far more experienced. The new Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, had been Ford's first White House chief of staff. Under Ford, Rumsfeld had proved exceptionally effective. Called back by the president from his assignment as ambassador to NATO, he had quickly organized the Ford White House and ruled over it with great skill until Ford appointed him to his first term as Secretary of Defense in 1975. After he returned to the private sector, Rumsfeld took the reins of a faltering G.D. Searle, a worldwide pharmaceutical company. I was brought on as the company's outside economic consultant and was fascinated to see this former U.S. Navy flight instructor, congressman, and government official fit so easily into the business world. Another stalwart from the Ford administration was the new Secretary of the Treasury, my friend Paul O'Neill. Paul had impressed everybody as Gerald Ford's Deputy Director of the Office of Management and Budget. His had been a mid-level job, yet we'd pulled Paul in for all the important meetings because he was one of the few with full command of the details of the budget. Leaving the government to join the business world, he'd risen to become CEO of Alcoa. I was on the board of directors that hired him. In 12 years in that job, he'd been a great success. But he was ready to retire from the company, and I was enthusiastic to learn he was at the top of the list for Treasury Secretary. Dick Cheney called to tell me that Paul had met with President-elect Bush and was feeling torn. "He's got two pages of pros and cons," Cheney said. "Can you talk to him?" I was delighted to pick up the phone. Using the same words with Paul that Arthur Burns had spoken to me in the waning days of the Nixon administration, I said, "We really need you down here." That argument had helped persuade me to leave New York and to go work in government for the first time, and it worked on Paul, too. I thought his presence would be an important plus for the new administration. Would the president's programs and budgets foster the American economy's long-term prospects? What would be the caliber of his economic advisors and staff? On those counts, it seemed to me that making Paul the man who signed the dollar bills was a major step in the right direction. There was another consideration, partly professional and partly personal. President Clinton had reappointed me early in 2000, so I had before me at least 3 more years as chairman. The Fed and the Treasury Department had made great music together throughout most of the 1990s. Granted, there had been the occasional discord over turf. We'd managed economic policy through the longest boom in modern U.S. history, improvised effectively in times of crisis, and helped the White House work down the horrendous federal deficits of the 1980s. My collaboration with Clinton's three Treasury secretaries, Lloyd Benson, Bob Rubin, and Larry Summers, had contributed to that success, and we considered one another friends for life. I wanted to build an equally fruitful dynamic with the incoming administration, for both the Fed's sake and my own, so I was gratified when Paul finally said yes. The most important returning Ford veteran, of course, was the vice president-elect. Dick Cheney had succeeded Rumsfeld, his mentor, as White House Chief of Staff, becoming at age 34 the youngest person ever to hold that post. With his combination of intensity and sometimes sphinx-like calm, he'd shown extraordinary skill in the job. The camaraderie we built in those years following Watergate had not waned. I would see him at Ford reunions and at other gatherings during his years as a congressman, and I was delighted when the first President Bush appointed him Secretary of Defense in 1989. There is little overlap between the duties of the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, yet we'd kept in touch. So now he was Vice President-elect. I knew that many commentators believed he would be much more than Vice President, because Cheney was so much more experienced in national and global affairs than George W. Bush, they thought he would become de facto head of government. I did not believe that. From my brief acquaintance with the President-elect, it was my impression that he was his own man. In the weeks following the election, Cheney sought my input, as I'm sure he sought the input of other old friends. He and his wife Lynn hadn't yet moved to the vice presidential residence at the Naval Observatory, so on Sunday afternoons I'd drive to their home in the Washington suburb of McLean, Virginia, where he and I would sit at the kitchen table or settle down in the den. The tone of our friendship shifted with his new position. I no longer called him Dick, but rather Mr. Vice President, and while he hadn't asked for this new formality, he acquiesced. Our talks were mainly about the challenges facing the United States. Often, we went into very specific detail. A key topic was energy. The recent oil price spike had been a reminder that even in the 21st century, supplies of basic industrial-age resources remained a major strategic concern. Indeed, Cheney's first major focus in office was to convene a task force on energy policy. So I gave him my analysis of oil's role in the economy and of how the international oil and natural gas markets were evolving. We discussed nuclear power, liquefied natural gas, and other alternatives. The greatest economic challenge on the domestic front, I argued, was the aging of 30 million baby boomers. Their retirement was no longer on the distant horizon, the way it had been when I'd become involved in Social Security reform under Reagan. The oldest boomers were set to turn 60 in 6 years, and the financial demands on the system would become extremely heavy in the decades beginning in 2010. Social Security and Medicare would need major revision to stay solvent and effective over that long term. Dick made it clear that domestic economic policy was not going to be his bailiwick. All the same, he was curious about my ideas. He listened closely and often took notes that I assumed he might pass along. During those last days of December and first days of January, I indulged in a bit of fantasy, envisioning this as the government that might have existed had Gerald Ford garnered the extra 1% of the vote he'd needed to edge past Jimmy Carter into a second term. What was more, for the first time since 1952, the Republican Party had ended up with not just the White House, but both houses of Congress. The Senate was actually split 50-50 between Republicans and Democrats, but as Senate President, Cheney would hold the tie-breaking vote. I thought we had a golden opportunity to advance the ideals of effective, fiscally conservative government and free markets. Reagan had brought conservatism back to the White House in 1980. Newt Gingrich had brought it back to Congress in 1994. But no one had put it together the way this new administration now had a chance to do. I looked forward to at least 4 years of working collegially with many of government's best and brightest, men with whom I had shared many memorable experiences. And on a personal basis, that is how it worked out. But on policy matters, I was soon to see my old friends veer off in unexpected directions. People's ideas, and sometimes their ideals, change over the years. I was a different person than I had been when first exposed to the glitter of the White House a quarter of a century before. So were my old friends. Not in personality or character, but in opinions about how the world works, and, therefore, what is important. In the weeks before the inauguration, the FOMC was scrambling to make sense of a complicated picture: the sudden slowdown of our $10 trillion a year economy and the practical implications for the Fed of the huge ongoing government surpluses. When the FOMC convened the day after my meeting with the president-elect, the downturn was at the top of the agenda. Recessions are tricky to forecast because they are driven in part by non-rational behavior. Sentiment about the economic outlook usually does not shift smoothly from optimism to neutrality to gloom. It's like the bursting of a dam, in which a flood backs up until cracks appear and the dam is breached. The resulting torrent carries with it whatever shreds of confidence there were, and what remains is fear. We seemed to be confronting just such a breach. As Bob McTeer, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, put it, "The R-word is now used openly just about everywhere." We decided that unless conditions improved over the next 2 or 3 weeks, interest rates would have to come down. For now, our position would be simply to express concern. As our public statement put it, "The committee will continue to monitor closely the evolving economic situation. The risks are weighted mainly toward conditions that may generate economic weakness in the foreseeable future." Or, as one committee member Riley translated, "We are not yet panicking." Within 2 weeks, it was plain that the downtrend was not leveling off. On January 3rd, the first business day of the new year, we convened again via conference call and cut the Fed funds rate by 0.5 percentage point to 6%. The media took this move as a surprise, even though we'd hinted at it before Christmas, but that was fine. The Fed was responding to the markets and the economy. In fact, we thought that this cut might be the first of many that would be necessary to stabilize the economy. I told the committee that it seemed to me any subsequent cuts might have to be made more quickly than usual. The same technology that was boosting productivity growth also might be speeding up the process of cyclical adjustment. A just-in-time economy demanded just-in-time monetary policy. Indeed, that would become our rationale as we cut the Fed funds rate by another half percentage point before January was out, and again in March, April, May, and June, bringing it all the way down to 3.75%. The other issue looming large for the FOMC was the disappearance of the national debt. Strange as it may seem in hindsight, in January 2001, the possibility was real. Nearly a decade of rising productivity growth and budget discipline had put the U.S. government in a position to generate surpluses as far as the eye could see, to borrow the phrase coined by President Reagan's budget director David Stockman in projecting deficits nearly two decades earlier. Even allowing for the recession that might now be setting in, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office was getting ready to raise its projection of the surplus to a stunning $5.6 trillion over 10 years. This was $3 trillion higher than the CBO had forecast in 1999, and $1 trillion more than it had predicted just the previous July. I'd always had doubts that budget surpluses could persist. Given the inherent tendency of politicians to err on the side of spending, I found it difficult to imagine Congress ever accumulating anything but deficits. My skepticism that surpluses were here to stay had been why, a year and a half before, I'd urged Congress to hold off on the nearly $800 billion 10-year tax cut that President Clinton ultimately vetoed. Yet I had to acknowledge that the general consensus among economists and statisticians I respected, not just at the CBO, but also at the Office of Management and Budget, at the Treasury, and at the Fed, was that under current policy, surpluses would continue to build. It seemed that the surge in productivity growth unleashed by the technology revolution was upsetting the old assumptions. As the evidence for this ongoing surplus mounted, I felt an odd sense of loss. The economic model I carried around in my head seemed obsolete. Congress was in fact not spending money faster than the Treasury was taking it in. Had human nature changed? For months I'd been wrestling with the idea that it might be possible. It was a question of do you believe your crazy old theories or your lying eyes? My colleagues at the FOMC seemed a bit disoriented, too. In our late January meeting, we spent hours trying to imagine how the Fed would operate in a brave new world of minimal federal debt. Of course, shedding the debt burden would be a happy development for our country, but it would nevertheless pose a big dilemma for the Fed. Our primary lever of monetary policy was buying and selling Treasury securities, Uncle Sam's IOUs. But as the debt was paid down, those securities would grow scarce, leaving the Fed in need of a new set of assets to affect monetary policy. For nearly a year, senior Fed economists and traders had been exploring the issue of what other assets we might buy and sell. A result was a dense 380-page study that plopped on our desks in January. The good news was that we weren't going out of business. The bad news was that nothing could really match the Treasury's market in size, liquidity, and freedom from risk. To conduct monetary policy, the report concluded, the Fed would have to learn to manage a complex portfolio of municipal bonds, bonds issued by foreign governments, mortgage-backed securities, auctioned discount window credits, and other debt instruments. It was a daunting prospect. I feel kind of like Alice in Wonderland, Kathy Minahan, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, had said when the issue first came up, and we all knew what she meant. The very fact of the discussion showed how profoundly and rapidly we thought the economic landscape might change. The surplus was also what had Paul O'Neill and me excited as we met during January to swap budget ideas. We both knew, of course, that the CBO's figure of $5.6 trillion over 10 years needed to be unpacked. About $3.1 trillion would be untouchable money, reserved for Social Security and Medicare. That left a prospective $2.5 trillion in usable funds. A major tax cut, of course, had been the centerpiece of George Bush's presidential campaign. He'd set himself apart from his father by vowing early on, "This is not only no new taxes, this is tax cuts, so help me God." Cutting taxes was the highest, best use of the surplus, Bush asserted, rejecting Al Gore's position that equally important priorities should be to pay down debt and create social programs. As Bush put it in the first debate, "My opponent thinks the surplus is the government's money. That's not what I think. I think it's the hard-working people of America's money. Taking a page out of Reagan's book, he was proposing a sweeping $1.6 trillion cut, phased in over 10 years across all tax brackets. Gore had campaigned on a $700 billion tax reduction. In the context of a major ongoing surplus, a tax cut of some sort was a sensible idea, O'Neill and I agreed. As he pointed out, taxes now accounted for more than 20% of GDP versus a historic average of 18%. But there were competing uses for the surplus to consider. Paying down government debt, most importantly, Al Gore had that right. Federal debt to the public, as it is technically called, now stood at $3.4 trillion. More than $2.5 trillion of this was considered reducible or readily paid off. Irreducible debt includes savings bonds and other securities that investors would decline to sell. Another major item on our wish list was Social Security and Medicare reform. I'd long hoped to see Social Security transformed into a system of private accounts. To launch such a change while meeting the obligations already on the books for today's workers and retirees would probably require $1 trillion of additional funds as a down payment, and the nation hadn't even begun to reckon with the ballooning costs of Medicare. We'd taken that issue off the table when I'd run the Social Security Reform Commission for President Reagan almost 20 years before, but with the aging of the baby boomers, the challenge was becoming urgent. I pointed out that the statisticians were counting an awful lot of unhatched chickens by forecasting surpluses 10 years ahead. What would happen if those surpluses failed to materialize? O'Neill took as dim a view of deficits as I did. His answer was triggers, provisions added to any new spending and tax legislation that would put off or reduce the cuts if the surplus disappeared. Some sort of capping mechanism might work, I agreed. One of the most important achievements of Congress and the last two administrations had been to make budget balancing the law of the land. The government now operated under so-called pay-go rules, whereby if you added a program, you had to come up with a source of funds for it, either by raising taxes or cutting other spending. We are not going back into the red, I declared. Events in January moved very quickly indeed. The preparations for a new administration and a new Congress are always hectic, and that year they were doubly so, because of the prolonged dispute over the outcome of the presidential race. Bush and his transition team had just 6 weeks instead of the usual 10 to gear up for Inauguration Day. Taxes were, as expected, the front-burner issue. In a private conversation in mid-January, Cheney told O'Neill and me that, after the disputed election, Bush felt that a clean victory on his tax cut was crucial. This echoed the uncompromising note I'd heard Cheney strike in a Sunday morning TV interview a few weeks before. As President-elect Bush has made very clear, he ran on a particular platform that was very carefully developed. It's his program and it's his agenda, and we have no intention at all of backing off of it. Having been around Washington a long time, I thought I recognized a familiar pattern. Campaign promises are the starting point of every new presidency. Each administration, as it takes office, puts out budget proposals and other plans identical to those in the campaign. The problem with turning such promises into policy, however, is that platforms are written for political perception, not optimal effect. The campaign agenda is a hastily constructed roadmap based on conditions at the time. By definition, it cannot be a fully vetted policy for operating government. Invariably, other forces in government, in Congress and the executive branch, act as a reality check, testing and tempering the plans. I knew this from experience. I'd worked for Nixon in his campaign of 1968 and for Reagan in 1980, and in no instance had the policy mix or forecast survived the early weeks of a new administration. I did not foresee how different the Bush White House would be. Their stance was, this is what we promised, this is what we'll deliver. And they meant it quite literally. Little value was placed on rigorous economic policy debate or the weighing of long-term consequences. As the president himself put it to O'Neill a couple of months later, in rejecting a suggestion on how the administration's plan for Social Security reform might be improved, I didn't go with that approach in the campaign. My friend soon found himself the odd man out. Much to my disappointment, economic policymaking in the Bush administration remained firmly in the hands of White House staff. The surplus was the first issue the Senate Budget Committee took up when the new Congress convened. That is how I found myself sitting under the bright lights of a hearing room on the morning of Thursday, January 25th, about to touch off a political furor. The key questions, as Committee Chairman Pete Domenici noted in welcoming me, were whether the projected long-term surplus would be transitory or permanent, and, if it did continue to rise, what do we do about it? My response in previous years had always been simply, pay off the debt. But now the projected surpluses were so large that debt repayment would be completed within a very few years. Yet the surplus would continue. The CBO statisticians now envisioned the surpluses under current policy at $281 billion in 2001, $313 billion in 2002, $359 billion in 2003, and so on. Assuming no major shift in fiscal policy, the CBO expected the reducible debt to be fully paid off by 2006. Any surpluses thereafter would have to be held in some form of non-federal assets. In 2006, the surplus would break $500 billion. Thereafter, more than a half trillion extra dollars would flow into Uncle Sam's coffers each year. As I contemplated this prospect, I felt a bit stunned. $500 billion is an almost unimaginable accumulation, roughly equivalent to the combined assets of America's five largest pension funds, piling up each year. What would the Treasury do with all that money? Where would it invest? The only private markets large enough to absorb such sums are in stocks, bonds, and real estate, in the United States and abroad. I found myself picturing American government officials becoming the world's largest investors. I'd encountered this prospect once before and found the idea truly scary. 2 years earlier, President Clinton had proposed investing $700 billion of Social Security funds in the stock market. To prevent political meddling with investment decisions, he suggested creating a privately managed mechanism to oversee the funds. But with such financial leverage at the government's disposal, I could readily envision the abuses that might occur under a Richard Nixon or a Lyndon Johnson. As I told the House Ways and Means Committee, I didn't believe it was politically feasible to insulate such huge funds from government direction. To my relief, Clinton dropped the idea soon after. Yet now it would very likely arise again. Taking all this into account, I came to a stark realization. Chronic surpluses could be almost as destabilizing as chronic deficits. Paying off the debt was not enough. I decided to propose a way for Uncle Sam to pay off his debts while leaving little or no additional surplus to invest once the debt reached zero. Spending would have to be raised or taxes cut, and to me, the preferable course seemed clear. I have always worried that once spending is notched up, it is difficult to rein in. The same is less true about tax cuts. There is no upper limit to spending, but tax revenues cannot go below zero. Moreover, lowering taxes eases the burden on private business, potentially raising the tax base. We could, alternatively, wait a couple of years and then, if the surpluses continued, reduce taxes sharply to eliminate them. But there was no way to know whether that would be a prudent option at the time. If inflation was pressing, tax cuts would end up stimulating an already overheated economy. The only course that did appeal to me was to act now to put fiscal policy on what I called a glide path to a balanced budget. This would involve phasing out the surpluses over the next several years through a combination of tax cuts and Social Security reform. Two pieces of tax cut legislation were already on the table. On the first day of the new Congress, Senators Phil Gramm and Zell Miller had introduced a bill embodying the $1.6 trillion plan from Bush's campaign, and Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle had introduced a more modest $700 billion plan. Either tax cut would serve my objective of scaling down the surplus while leaving enough money for Social Security reform. Of course, I still had the fear in the back of my mind that Congress and the White House might again go overboard on spending, or that revenues would unexpectedly flag, either of which would cause deficits to come back with a vengeance. So, in writing my testimony, I was careful to include Paul O'Neill's notion of making the tax cuts conditional. I asked Congress to consider provisions that limit surplus-reducing actions if specified targets for the budget surplus and federal debt were not satisfied. If chronic surpluses did not develop as forecast, then the tax cuts or newly enacted spending increases should be curtailed. I could not shake a conviction of many decades that the biases in our political system favor deficits. so I made sure to end the statement on a strong note of caution. With today's euphoria surrounding the surpluses, I wrote, it is not difficult to imagine the hard-earned fiscal restraint developed in recent years rapidly dissipating. We need to resist those policies that could readily resurrect the deficits of the past and the fiscal imbalances that followed in their wake. My office provided the Budget Committee leaders with a copy of my remarks a day in advance, as we often did with complex testimony that had no direct bearing on the financial markets. I was surprised on Wednesday afternoon to get a call from the committee's ranking Democrat, Kent Conrad of North Dakota. He asked if I could stop by his office to talk. A former tax commissioner, Conrad had been in the Senate as long as I'd been chairman and had a reputation as a fiscal conservative. After thanking me for taking the time to see him, the senator went straight to the point. "You're going to create a feeding frenzy," he said. "Why are you backing the Bush tax cut?" He predicted that my testimony would not only ensure the passage of the White House proposals, but also encourage Congress to jettison the fragile consensus on fiscal discipline it had built up over the years. "That is not what I'm saying at all," I told him, pointing out that my testimony endorsed a tax cut of some kind to remove the surplus, but not necessarily the president's. My ultimate goals were still debt reduction and zero deficits. I went over my assessment of how dramatically the outlook on the surplus had changed, explaining how productivity growth, according to virtually all analysts, seemed on a permanently higher path, or on a higher path at least for the years immediately ahead. That had fundamentally altered the outlook for revenues. Finally, I agreed that it remained crucial to emphasize fiscal restraint, and volunteered to expand on the need for a safety mechanism like O'Neill's triggers if the senator would ask me about it during the Q&A. When I left, I could see that Senator Conrad wasn't entirely satisfied with this response, but I didn't buy the idea that Congress would act on my say-so. Politicians had never hesitated to discount or ignore my recommendations in the past as it served their convenience. I do not recall my turning the tide when I advocated cuts in Social Security benefits. I had no intention of taking sides on whose tax cut was better. As I would tell Senator Domenici the following morning at the hearing when he asked me to endorse the Bush plan, that was a fundamentally political question. I was an analyst, not a politician. The job would be no fun if I had to worry about the political implications of everything I said. I was offering what I thought was a novel insight and hoped my testimony would add an important dimension to the debate. I went back to the Fed and hadn't been at my desk for even an hour when Bob Rubin phoned. "Kent Conrad called me," he said. "He said I needed to talk to you before you testify." Bob hadn't read my statement, but Conrad had filled him in, and he told me he shared some of the senator's concerns. "With a big tax cut," said Bob, "the risk is you lose the political mindset of fiscal discipline." He and I had labored for years to promote that consensus. So I asked if he knew that I was still presenting debt reduction as the ultimate goal. "I understand that," he said. "Then what was the problem?" I asked. "Bob, where in my testimony do you disagree?" There was silence. Finally, he replied, "The issue isn't so much what you're saying, it's how it's going to be perceived." "I can't be in charge of people's perceptions," I responded wearily. "I don't function that way. I can't function that way." It turned out that Conrad and Rubin were right. The tax cut testimony proved to be politically explosive. The hubbub began even before I reached Capitol Hill. Copies of my statement had leaked, and USA Today that morning ran a front-page headline, "Greenspan to Back Tax Cuts." Both Conrad and Domenici were quoted in the accompanying story, with Domenici confirming that I was about to change my position on tax cuts because the surplus is so big. The hearing room itself was as full as I'd ever seen it, with 20 senators and their staffs, a wall of cameras, and a substantial crowd. Reading my statement took nearly half an hour, and afterward I wasn't sure what to expect. Senator Conrad started by thanking me for what he declared was a very balanced approach, a gracious thing to say, I thought, as I hadn't changed a word after the previous day's conversation. Then he asked, "As I hear you testifying, you're proposing that we don't abandon fiscal discipline?" "Absolutely, Senator," I answered, dancing the little pas de deux I'd suggested the previous day. I amplified on my views about the continued need for debt reduction and fiscal restraint. Then it was the other senator's turn, and for the 2 hours that followed, the questioning split sharply along party lines. While both sides had been proposing a tax cut, the Republicans were clearly the ones thrilled to hear me bless the idea. "I think we pretty well know where we're going," said Phil Graham of Texas. "The sooner we write the budget, the better, and get on with it." The Democrats, in their comments, mostly voiced dismay. "You're going to start a stampede," said Fritz Hollings of South Carolina. Paul Sarbanes of Maryland chimed in. "It wouldn't be far off the mark for the press to carry the story, Greenspan takes the lid off of Punch Bowl." The most vivid complaint was from the longest-serving senator in American history, Bob Byrd. In his West Virginia drawl, he began, "Now, I'm a Baptist. We have a hymnal. We have a song in our hymnal. The anchor holds. And I've looked at you through this economic expansion period, and I've considered you to be a great portion of the anchor. I have listened to you over the past several years that we need to pay down the debt. That is the basic need. I believe that you were right then, and I am somewhat stunned by the fact that the anchor seems to be wavering today." Remarks like that are the kind people remember. As the hearing ended, I was optimistic that the ideas I'd set forth, the risks of excessive surpluses, the glide path proposal, the notion of a trigger, would in the long run get attention as the legislative process proceeded. But for the moment, I resigned myself to the idea that my testimony would be politically framed. I later told my wife, "I am shocked, shocked, that there is politics on Capitol Hill." The White House was quick to signal its pleasure. President Bush himself met with reporters that evening to call my testimony measured and just right. The major newspapers, too, saw the testimony as political. "Tax cuts are inevitable, and it makes sense for Mr. Greenspan to avoid disagreeing with the new administration at this early stage," wrote the Financial Times. The New York Times reported that I was helping the White House in much the same way as I had supported President Clinton's deficit-cutting initiative when he first took office in 1993. Just as his hedged backing of Mr. Clinton's plan provided invaluable political cover, as the Democrats voted to raise taxes, his guarded endorsement of a tax cut today gave new impetus to the effort by Republicans to push through the biggest tax cut since the Reagan administration. Reading these comments, I saw that while politics had not been my intent, I'd misjudged the emotions of the moment. We had just gone through a constitutional crisis over an election, which, I realized in hindsight, is not the best time to try to put across a nuanced position based on economic analysis. Yet, I'd have given the same testimony if Al Gore had been president. I did what I could to keep the concept of triggers in play during the weeks that followed. In congressional hearings in February and March, I repeatedly drew attention to the tentativeness of all forecasts and continued to bang the drum for installing safeguards. It is crucial that we develop budgetary strategies that deal with any disappointments that could occur, I told a House committee on March 2nd. A few days later, a small bipartisan group of Senate fiscal conservatives called a press conference and declared that triggers were the way to go. I'd met with and encouraged this group, 5 Republicans and 6 Democrats, led by Olympia Snow of Maine. But triggers, it turned out, never stood much of a chance. Neither side's leadership liked the idea. On the day of my testimony, when reporters asked White House spokesman Ari Fleischer about adding anti-deficit safeguards to the president's tax cut, he answered flatly, "We need to make it the permanent law of the land." Soon after, Time magazine quoted chief political adviser Karl Rove calling the trigger concept dead on arrival with this president. And when President Bush formally unveiled his 2002 budget plan in February, it incorporated the $1.6 trillion tax cut just as he had proposed it during the campaign. The Democratic leadership rejected the trigger concept as well. "You don't need a trigger if you limit the size of a tax cut," said Senate Minority Leader Daschle. In early March, the Republican House leadership decisively blocked a trigger amendment from reaching the floor, and the House passed the Bush tax cut virtually unchanged. When the debate shifted to the Senate, triggers never drew any additional support. In the end, Bush had his victory. At $1.35 trillion, the tax cut that ultimately took shape was smaller than he had wanted, about halfway between the Republican and Democratic plans. But it was structured a la Bush as an across-the-board cut. The legislation embodied only one major feature that had not been part of the original plan: a taxpayer rebate designed to give back nearly $40 billion of the 2001 surplus. It mandated that each working household was to receive up to $600, depending on how much income tax it had paid the year before. Congress approved the Bush rebate, as it came to be called, as a short-term stimulus aimed at jolting the economy from its stupor. American taxpayers will have more money in their pockets, the president declared, and the economy will receive a well-deserved shot in the arm. He signed the tax cut into law on June 7th, record time for a major budget initiative. I was willing to be optimistic about the legislation's effect. It would work down the surpluses before they became dangerous. And though the tax cut had not been designed as a short-term stimulus, the economy hadn't needed one when Bush's people conceived it during the campaign, it could prove serendipitously to have that effect. The timing was now right. My regret that the legislation had passed without triggers, however, was soon to become a lot more intense. Within weeks, it turned out that I'd been wrong to abandon my skepticism about the ongoing surplus. Those rosy 10-year forecasts were, in fact, utterly mistaken. Even before the Bush rebate checks were in the mail, suddenly and inexplicably, federal revenues plunged. The flow of personal income tax payments to the Treasury, as seasonally adjusted by the Department of Commerce, started to come up billions of dollars short. The vaunted surplus, still going strong when Bush signed the tax cut in June and forecast to continue for many years, was effectively wiped out overnight. Starting that July, red ink was back to stay. Our best statisticians got blindsided by this change. It took budget experts many months, tabulating tens of millions of tax returns, to piece together what went wrong. The revenue shortfall was evidently a reflection of the stock market's broad, ongoing decline. Between January and September 2001, the S&P 500 lost more than 20% of its value. This caused a sharp fall in taxes on capital gains and the exercise of stock options, a decline far more abrupt than the experts had forecast. Just as the bull market of the tech boom had generated the surplus, the post-dot-com bear market took it away. How could the forecasts have been so colossally wrong? The mildness of the economic downturn had fooled the tax statisticians into expecting a gentler drop in receipts. But by 2002, the extent of the collapse was evident in the numbers. In January 2001, the CBO had estimated total receipts at $2.236 trillion for fiscal year 2002. By August 2002, that figure had shrunk to $1.860 trillion, a $376 billion downward revision in 18 months. Of that money, $75 billion reflected the Bush tax cut and $125 billion the weakening of economic activity. The other $176 billion, a startlingly large sum, reflected what budgeters call technical changes, code language for items that cannot be explained by what is going on in the economy or on Capitol Hill, such as blown estimates of taxes from capital gains. That September, Bob Woodward came to my office to interview me on the state of the economy. He was preparing a new chapter for the paperback edition of Maestro, his bestseller about me and the Fed. I told him I was puzzled by the course the 2001 recession was taking. It was like nothing I'd ever seen. Following December's sharp break in confidence and the significant decline in stock prices through the summer, I'd steeled myself for a marked downturn in GDP. Industrial production was off 5% during the year. GDP, however, held steady. Instead of being in a deep valley, we were on a plateau. Indeed, it would turn out that the economy actually eked out a slight expansion for the year. The shallowness of the recession looked to be a consequence of global economic forces that had driven long-term interest rates lower and ignited a sharp rise in home prices in many parts of the world. In the United States, homes had increased in value so much that households, feeling flush, seemed more willing to spend. That, coupled with underlying productivity growth, appeared to have endowed the American economy with a whole new degree of buoyancy. So, said Woodward, trying to sum up, maybe the story of the economy this year is the disaster averted rather than the downturns. It's too soon to tell, I answered. Until the whole thing settles down into a boring pattern, you can't know. The conversation was not much different from a dozen other background sessions I'd held with reporters in the course of the summer, except for the timing. It was Thursday, September 6th, just before I was to leave for an international bankers' meeting in Switzerland. The date on the airplane ticket for my return was Tuesday, September 11th. Chapter 11. The Nation Challenged. For a full year and a half after September 11th, 2001, we were in limbo. The economy managed to expand, but its growth was uncertain and weak. Businesses and investors felt besieged. The immediate crises of the first few months, the hunt for Al-Qaeda suspects, the anthrax attacks, the Afghanistan war, gave way to the low-grade strain of coping with domestic securities anxieties and costs. Enron's bankruptcy in December 2001 compounded the uncertainty and gloom. It touched off a wave of accounting scandals and bankruptcies, exposing the infectious greed and malfeasance that had been the dark side of the great economic boom. At times, there seemed no end to disturbing news. The controversy over campaign finance, the sniper killings in Washington, D.C., the terrorist bombing of a nightclub district in Bali. In summer 2002, telecom giant WorldCom collapsed in a cloud of accounting fraud. At $107 billion in assets, it was the biggest bankruptcy in history. Then came SARS, the lethal flu-like contagion that began in China and for weeks disrupted business travel and trade. During that period, of course, the administration was stepping up its attacks on Saddam Hussein, and in March and April 2003, the invasion of Iraq and Saddam's overthrow dominated the headlines. Behind everything loomed the expectation of continued terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. In official Washington, especially, it was hard to shake the feeling of imminent threat. New traffic barriers, checkpoints, surveillance cameras, and heavily armed guards were everywhere. For me, there was no more strolling a couple of blocks on the way to work, past TV cameras for the briefcase indicator. Each morning, I was driven into the Fed's heavily guarded underground garage. Visitors to the Fed, though still allowed to park there, would have to wait as a dog sniffed the car for explosives. The dog would actually get into the trunk. There was no bigger question in Washington than, why no second attack? If Al-Qaeda's intent was to disrupt the U.S. economy, as bin Laden had declared, the attacks had to continue. Our society was open, our borders were porous, and our ability to detect weapons and bombs was weak. I asked this question of a lot of people at the highest levels of government, and no one seemed to have a convincing response. The expectation of additional terrorism affected virtually everything the government did, and inevitably, the defensive bubble we'd created to protect our institutions influenced every decision. In 2002, the new Homeland Security program was prepared to significantly curtail individual freedoms by such measures as tightening identification requirements, stepping up identity checks, restricting travel, and limiting privacy. The Homeland Security Act itself was less draconian, but did curtail civil liberties by making it easier for the government to deny Freedom of Information Act requests, by imposing criminal penalties on officials who disclosed critical infrastructure information obtained from private companies, and by developing a program that would monitor citizens' everyday lives. The leaders of both parties were on board. But when no further attacks came, the politicians gradually reverted to their pre-9/11 positions on civil liberties, some more quickly than others. It is interesting to hypothesize how the United States would look today if there had been a second, third, and fourth attack. Could our culture stand it? Would we be able to maintain a viable economy as the Israelis have, and as Londoners did during the decades of bombings by the Irish Republican Army? I had great confidence that we could, but there is always that doubt. The Fed's response to all this uncertainty was to maintain our program of aggressively lowering short-term interest rates. This extended a series of 7 cuts we'd already made in early 2001 to mitigate the impact of the dot-com bust and the general stock market decline. After the September 11th attacks, we cut the Fed funds rate 4 times more, and then once again at the height of the corporate scandals in 2002. By October of that year, the Fed funds rate stood at 1.25%, a figure most of us would have considered unfathomably low a decade before. Indeed, rates had not been so low since the days of Dwight Eisenhower. As officials whose entire careers had been devoted to fighting inflation, we found the experience of making such cuts decidedly strange. Yet, the economy was clearly in the grip of disinflation, in which market forces combined to hold down wages and prices and cause inflation expectations, and hence long-term interest rates, to recede. So, inflation, for the moment at least, was not a problem. Between 2000 and 2003, long-term interest rates continued to decline. The rate on 10-year treasuries dropped from nearly 7% to less than 3.5%. It was clear that the ultimate explanation extended far beyond American shores, because long-term interest rates around the world also were trending down. Globalization was exerting a disinflationary impact. We put that broader issue aside to wrestle with the immediate challenge facing the Fed, a weakened economy. The FOMC's working assumption was that rising prices did not pose an imminent threat, and that gave us the flexibility to lower short-term rates. By 2003, however, the economic funk and disinflation had gone on so long that the Fed had to consider a more exotic peril, a declining price level, deflation. This was the possibility that the U.S. economy might be entering a crippling spiral like the one we'd seen paralyze Japan for 13 years. I found it to be a very unsettling issue. In modern economies, whose chronic headache is inflation, deflation is a rare disease. After all, the United States was no longer on a gold standard. I couldn't conceive of deflation occurring under a fiat money standard. I'd always assumed that if deflation seemed imminent, we could start up the printing presses and create as many dollars as would be necessary to stop a deflationary spiral. Now I was not so sure. Japan had figuratively opened its money taps, driven interest rates to zero, and run a large budget deficit, yet its price level had continued to fall. The Japanese seemed unable to break the grip of deflation, and must have been quite fearful that they were in the type of downward spiral that nobody had witnessed since the 1930s. Deflation became the focus of increasing concern within the Fed. While the economy eked out 1.6% real GDP growth during 2002, it clearly was being constrained. Even powerful companies like Aetna and SBC Communications were showing weak profits, laying people off, and reporting difficulty making price increases stick. Unemployment had risen from 4% at the end of 2000 to 6%. At the FOMC meeting in late June, where we voted to reduce interest rates still further, to 1%, deflation was topic A. We agreed on the reduction, despite our consensus that the economy probably did not need yet another rate cut. The stock market had finally begun to revive, and our forecasts called for much stronger GDP growth in the year's second half. Yet we went ahead on the basis of a balancing of risk. We wanted to shut down the possibility of corrosive deflation. We were willing to chance that by cutting rates we might foster a bubble, an inflationary boom of some sort, which we would subsequently have to address. I was pleased at the way we'd weighed the contending factors. Time would tell if it was the right decision, but it was a decision done right. Consumer spending carried the economy through the post-9/11 malaise, and what carried consumer spending was housing. In many parts of the United States, residential real estate, energized by the fall in mortgage interest rates, began to see values surge. The market prices of existing homes rose 7.5% a year in 2000, 2001, and 2002, more than double the rate of just a few years before. Not only did construction of new houses rise to record levels, but also historic numbers of existing houses changed hands. This boom provided a big lift in morale. Even if your house was not for sale, you could look down the block and see other people's homes going for what seemed like astonishing prices, which meant your house was worth more too. By early 2003, 30-year mortgages were below 6%, the lowest they'd been since the 60s. Adjustable-rate mortgages cost even less. This spurred the turnover of houses that drove prices higher. Since 1994, the proportion of American householders who became homeowners had accelerated. By 2006, nearly 69% of households owned their own home, up from 64% in 1994 and 44% in 1940. The gains were especially dramatic among Hispanics and blacks, as increasing affluence as well as government encouragement of subprime mortgage programs enabled many members of minority groups to become first-time homebuyers. This expansion of ownership gave more people a stake in the future of our country and boded well for the cohesion of the nation, I thought. Homeownership resonates as deeply today as it did a century ago. Even in a digital age, brick and mortar, or plywood and sheetrock, are what stabilize us and make us feel at home. Capital gains, especially gains realized in cash, began burning holes in people's pockets. Soon, statisticians could see a bulge in consumer spending that matched the surge in capital gains. Some analysts estimated that 3% to 5% of the increase in housing wealth showed up annually in the demand for all manner of goods and services, from cars and refrigerators to vacations and entertainment. And, of course, people poured money into home modernization and expansion, further fueling the boom. This pickup in outlays was virtually all funded through increases in home mortgage debt, which financial institutions made particularly easy to tap. When a home changed hands, the buyer almost invariably took out a mortgage that exceeded the unpaid balance on the seller's outstanding mortgage. The net increase of debt on the house went as cash to the seller. Such home equity extraction tends to track, but is not exactly equal to, the realized capital gain on the sale. The net effect was characterized neatly by economics columnist Robert Samuelson, who wrote in Newsweek on December 30, 2002, "The housing boom saved the economy. Fed up with the stock market, Americans went on a real estate orgy. We traded up, tore down, and added on." Booms, of course, beget bubbles, as the owners of dot-com stocks had painfully learned. Were we setting ourselves up for a harrowing real estate crash? That concern started to surface in hot markets like San Diego and New York, where prices in 2002 jumped by 22% and 19% respectively, and where some investors now began viewing houses and condos as the latest way to get rich quick. The Fed tracked such developments closely. As the boom rolled on, the evidence of speculation became hard to miss. The market for single-family homes in the United States had always been predominantly for home ownership, with the proportion of purchases for investment or speculation rarely more than 10%. Such purchases are largely made by people who purchase and rent out dwellings. Often, such an individual is the owner of a condominium or of a two-family attached house, one unit of which is rented out. But by 2005, investors accounted for 20%